This episode of Pub Talk Live was broadcast on May 23rd, 2020, with guest co-host I.W. Gregorio and special guest Ellen O. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the May 23rd episode of Pub Talk Live, the live publishing talk show airing the second and fourth Saturday of every month at 9 p.m. Eastern. I am your host, Sarah Nicholas. I'm a young adult author, a board member, and agent liaison for Pitch Wars, a library event planner. You can subscribe to reminders via email by clicking on the link in the description so you don't miss a show, so you can get an email the day of just to remind you about it. And you can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live. If you'd like to support the show, you can find a link to the Patreon near the end of the video description down below. And new developments since last episode, a couple people upped their Patreon sponsorships to the podcast sponsor. So the replays are now available as a podcast. And so this one, once I get it edited, I'll upload that and it will join all the podcasts. So I'm really thankful for that. And thank y'all so much for letting that happen for me. All right. So I'm going to bring on our guest co-host. I.W. Gregorio is a practicing surgeon by day, masked avenging YA writer by night. After getting her MD, she did a residency at Stanford where she met the intersex patient who inspired her debut novel, None of the Above, which was a Lambda literary finalist, a Publishers Weekly Flying Start, and an ALA Rainbow List selection. Her next novel, This Is My Brain in Love, has received 3 starred reviews and was named a best YA book of April 2020 by Amazon.com editors. She is a proud board member of Interact, Advocates for Intersex Youth, and is a founding member of We Need Diverse Books. Her essays have been published in Newsweek, Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle, Philadelphia Inquirer, and Scientific American, among others. So please welcome to the show, I.W. Gregorio. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks so much for coming on. I was so happy when you commented on that post saying you wanted to be on. Let's see. Jay is here. Hello, Jay. Hello. Ebony, good to see you again. So Eileen, some of the people who watch the show regularly, they chose a name for themselves. And so they're called Pubbers. Yeah.
Great.
Which is just awesome. Hi, Ryan. So glad you came back. Heather, hi again. All right. Thank you all for joining us tonight. So we have the viewer poll going on right now. And hey, Sarah. Thank you so much. Sarah was on the last show. She was a guest on the last show.
Oh,
so.
Sarah.
So the viewer poll is up. It will be up for about 20 more minutes. So make sure you go vote in that if you haven't already. And the question was, where do you purchase most of your print books from? And when I was developing the question, I told my friend, I know it should be from where do you purchase most of your print books? But I refuse because that's awkward. Hey, Catherine. I'm glad you're here. All right. So we have actually fewer news items than we normally do for you. So this might go a little bit quicker than it usually does. But some things happening in the world of publishing this week. So Rick Riordan announced on Twitter that there will be a live action adaptation of the highest quality made for Disney Plus. Riordan, who has expressed dissatisfaction with the movies, said in the announcement that Becky and I will be involved in person in every aspect of the show.
That's so funny, because I remember watching The Lightning Thief movie with my kids, and they actually kind of enjoyed it, and so did I. Like, I feel like I had low expectations. I actually have not read the books, but my daughter has. After we watched it, there were a couple of things plot-wise that I thought seemed a little off. And so I remember going through and like reading the open letter that Rick wrote to like the producers. It was kind of a nice shade that he said of the highest quality. But like, it's really interesting because I never would have known if I hadn't digged deeper.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually hadn't read the books. I'm just going to tilt my camera a little bit. Okay, I hadn't read the books. My sister read them right before the movie came out. And then the movie came out and she was so mad. She hated it. So So I actually never even watched the movie because I was like, because me and my sister have very similar tastes. So, yeah. Jessica has joined us. Hey, Jessica. But that should be exciting. I'm excited that he's involved and his wife is involved as well. Yeah. And he says with every aspect of the show. So hopefully he gets a do-over.
Well, he was involved, I think, in the Broadway show as well, right? Mm-hmm. I know I haven't seen yet, but my daughter has started to have some of her friends sing some of the big songs from it. And so like, I'm anxious to have it be a point where we can see live performances again so I could see it.
Yeah, right.
So I think the second, do we want to go on to the second news
item? Go for it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the second news item we had was Rakuten, which I think is the right way to pronounce that, who sponsors the Kobo e-reader, revealed in their earnings call that they were seeing a huge surge in demand because of the pandemic. And in the first 3 months of 2020, they saw 2.2 million new customers enrolled worldwide. And that was really amazing to me. And when I started thinking about it, I am one of those 2.2 million new subscribers. And the reason I did it was because so many of my indie bookstores, you know, weren't able to provide as many services, but many of them get a kickback through Kobo if you buy it through their store. It's definitely, there are layers of how you need to sign up, you need to link your bookstore to it, you need to download their app if you don't have a Kindle or anything, because obviously they need to bring it to a Kindle, but it's a really pretty seamless app, and I was really happy with it and happy to get at least some of it going to my indie bookstores. And so I imagine that a lot of people are realizing that we have to spread the wealth a little bit when it comes to ebooks.
Nice. Yeah. So you're one of those 2.2 million. That's great. And I think a lot of people don't realize, because like we think about Kobo in the US, it's like not super popular, but it's actually one of the most popular e-readers in a lot of other countries, including Canada, especially Canada. Also, I think a lot of people are looking for ways to support their indies while they're not open, you know, like you mentioned.
Absolutely.
Because I know bookshop.org, which just launched, I think, in like February, people were kind of like skeptical about it. And then the pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a way to buy physical books and support bookstores still. And their business has taken off way more than they expected. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably a mixture, of those things. And people probably just need to read more too. All right, Apple. Oh, go ahead. No.
Oh, I'm saying, but it's nice that people aren't doing it the easy way. You know, it's so much easier when it's when the shop and the app are sort of already on your phone through the A word.
Yeah. The A word. I don't buy books from Amazon. I bought other things from Amazon, but it's usually, I have like a rule, like if I can't find it in two or three different stores, then I can buy it on Amazon. But obviously that's not happening at all right now. But yeah. All right. Apple has launched a resource site called Apple Books for authors, along with a new publishing portal that allows PC-using writers to distribute their books directly to Apple Books. So previously, you could only distribute directly if you had an Apple computer. A lot of people use like kind of like an aggregator, like Smashwords or something like that. So I know a lot of people are really excited. A lot of self-published authors are really excited about this. They have a little more control over their Apple listings. So, hey, Jennifer. Jennifer joined us. And Raquel from Writer's Atelier. Raquel from Writer's Atelier is going to be in the second June episode. So make sure you come back for that. And Jennifer thinks the A word is hilarious. I know Jennifer for sure is not an A-word supporter. So.
Yeah, mixed feelings there, definitely. Yeah. There are certainly people who who that's their primary source of books and for recommendations. I mean, it's sort of built in. It's part of the life. Mm-hmm. But I just, when you think, when you're a writer, you're just aware that publishing is such an ecosystem. And yes, Amazon is, you know, the big fish in the small pond, but plankton are nice. it tastes different, you know. And as an author, like, I value in-person events so much mm-hmm. for allowing me to interact with my readers and to meet other authors. And so obviously now that the pandemic isn't here, it's much harder to get that indie feel. But even now, indie bookstores are still doing a lot more online events and conversations and Zooms. So, you know, I feel like they're still providing a service even when you can't be there physically.
Yeah, and a lot of them are, I mean, their booksellers are still available if you're looking for recommendations. You know, is a great, because you can be so specific. So you can go to Amazon, you can see the reviews, and that's nice. Like, honestly, I love seeing that many reviews in one place. But if you're looking for something really specific, like, we at Book Riot get questions all the time that are like, I would like, you know, a contemporary mystery thriller, but I can't handle any child abuse or any child getting hurt or something like that. That's something that's really hard to find unless you're talking to someone, you know, like a bookseller or a librarian. So,
yeah.
Hey, Del, so glad you could join us. Jennifer wants a shirt that says plankton are nice.
Okay, I'll have my daughter do that on her Etsy site.
Nice.
Like,
all right. So, some sad news.
Yeah, the next news item is really sad. Thomas Lowe, who is the co-founder of Lee and Lowe Books, passed away this week due to cancer. As many of you guys know, Lee and Lowe is a smaller publisher that was founded 30 years ago with the intention of spotlighting diverse and inclusive stories. I mean, they were the people who did We Need Diverse Books before We Need Diverse Books did. And I remember vividly, some editors from Lee and Lowe being involved in the very early stages of We Need Diverse Books. And I remember Jason, I think it's Jason Lee, or Jason Lowe, one of the current editors, who said in an interview that book buying was a political act. And that is absolutely one of, like, those revelatory statements that changed the way that I viewed, you know, where I purchased books and what books I purchased. And it's a really, really sad day, because for so long, publishing has been dominated by the voices of, you know, white straight people. And to have a publishing imprint that, you know, focuses exclusively on diverse work. They have a New Voices Award. There are some amazing debut authors who got their start through the Lee and Lowe Diverse New Voices program. And they also definitely champion Native books as well. So. It's a sad thing.
Yeah, and they also put out the report every year that's like the state of diversity in children's publishing.
Yeah, I think now so Sarah Park Dalen in Minnesota, I think she's kind of, she does a graphic, and then there's the collaborative Children's Book Center in the Midwest as well. But Lee and Lowe definitely were some of the first ones to really make it mainstream, make those eye-catching graphics that, you know, because, I mean, that one of the reasons We Need Diverse Books worked as a hashtag was that it was a very visual thing, the signs, and with Lee and Lowe and their graphics, you know, bringing that to the attention, it was such a powerful tool. And I feel like I have Lee and Lowe stats in pretty much every presentation that I do, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were really ahead of their time. But his sons run the company now.
Yeah, Jason.
Yeah. All right, so this is something that we've kind of been covering on and off since December, I think. Yeah, December. Romance Writers of America, after everything that happened earlier in the year. We're not going to get into all of it because it was a lot. you can go back and watch some of the previous episodes. they have retired the annual Rita Award, and they're introducing a new award called the Vivian, and is named after RWA founder Vivian Stevens, who was a Black woman. The new format will be proposed at the RWA board meeting at the end of this month, so we don't know exactly what it's going to look like. But to find out more and read a statement from Vivian Stevens, you can visit the link in the description later tonight. If this is your first time watching, all the news items that we talk about after the show ends, I drop the links for each of them in the description, so you can go and read more about each of them if you'd like.
I just wanted to say the comment from Del Cecil. Thank you so much for bringing that up. And definitely the We Need Diverse Books definition of diversity includes both disability and religious and cultural diversity as well. So,
And Leanne Lowe's did as well, too. Oh, I just hit my mic stand again. All right. So, yeah, the RWA is going to have a brand new award. And I think they're hoping that this is going to solve some of the issues previously with award. If you didn't know, until the last year or the year before last, a Black woman had never won a Rita in 30 years. So it obviously had some bias issues. It's peer judged. So it had a lot of issues. So I don't know how you're going to control that, but hopefully they can make some strides forward. They keep calling the way forward RW 2.0. The board does. So I know some of the people involved, and I know they're true believers. They really want to make it an inclusive organization. So hopefully they're able to get that done. I know they're fighting membership that push back against it, but I'm hopeful.
Yeah, it's really hard being a leader of organizations like that, because they have to represent so many different constituents, but this is hopefully a step in the right direction. It's really great. The next news item also sort of directly involves independent bookstores, and it's the fact that Macmillan and Hachette announced that they were offering new terms to indie bookstores, such as additional discounts and longer times to pay balances. So Macmillan VP Jen Gonzalez said these terms hopefully offer stores some leeway to help survive the pandemic and beyond. And obviously, I think it's a great tip of the hat to indies to show that publishing really values them. As I say, they like the plankton.
And there are a couple other publishers that are offering similar terms. Macmillan is just, probably the biggest, I think, at this point. I think publishing is realizing how much of an ecosystem it is and how much they need indie bookstores. And so they're trying to support them in any way that they can without also while also still making money, So we actually have a lot of indie bookstore news today. I think it's because it's just that time, right? Like, everyone's trying to figure out how to adapt to this world that we're living in now. And indie bookstores are trying to do everything they can to survive. And we've seen some closures being announced, some permanent closures being announced. And so any support that y'all can provide is great too. So I just want to, excuse me, I need to get a drink of my water. So if you can shop in a way that supports indie bookstores, please do that. And you can support indie bookstores if you listen to audiobooks as well at Libro.fm, which is who I use to do my audiobook giveaways. So all right, let's see. Oh, Sarah said Penguin Random House is offering great terms for indie bookstores now too, longer times to pay, etc. Cool, great. Yeah, hopefully all of the big houses will do that. Jason, that's awesome. Heather's a thumbs up. All right, so our last news item for the day before we bring on our special guest, dozens of illustrators have, and this, of course, book illustrators, mainly, have sent indie bookstores art for them to give away to encourage shoppers. And so you can see some of the art that's being given away in the article. Basically, they send it to the indie bookstores, and the indie bookstores can either say, you know, the first 100 orders gets this thing, or the first, or, you know, we'll give it away to every 10th order or something like that. And so that's pretty cool that illustrators are jumping on now trying to help indie bookstores as well.
Yeah, I saw that. It's an adorable little idea that just gives you a sense of the value added that indie bookstores do, like the fact that you can get signed and personalized books there. You know, it's something that's so integral to what indies add to the experience. And when there's no in-person thing, it's just so sad. So like, I know a lot of authors I know, including myself, are still like sending signed book plates to people who buy books from indie bookstores just so that they can get a slice of that experience. Mm-hmm.
Dell had asked, what's the audiobook thing? It's Libro FM. So it's Libro. I think their website is Libro.fm. And it's, a service that sells audiobooks, but you can choose a bookstore to support, or you can choose just supporting bookstores in general. And they kind of like split it in the pot. But they have a subscription that's very much like the Audible subscription. It's the same price, the same books are available. And so you can do the, you know, it's like $15 a month for one ebook, no matter what the price is. And that's what I use. And they also give you discounts if you're a subscriber. They also give you discounts on additional books as well. So it's pretty great. I like it. And their app is good. It's funny when I tweet about this, people are always like, but how is the app? I'm like, the app is good. Like they're all, a lot of audiobook apps are all the same anyway. They're all the same software behind them. All right, so it is time to bring on our special guest. I'm very excited. Our special guest today is Ellen Oh. Ellen Oh is an award-winning author of the middle grade novels Dragon Egg Princess, The Spirit Hunters, and its sequel Island of the Monsters, and the YA fantasy trilogy The Prophecy series, which includes Prophecy, Warrior, and King. She is also co-founder of We Need Diverse Books, a nonprofit organization dedicated to increasing diversity in children's literature. Formerly a lawyer and college instructor, Ellen lives in Maryland with her husband and three children. Hi. Hello.
How are you guys?
Welcome to the show, Ellen.
Thank you. I had to shoo one of my children away just as you were bringing me on.
I saw that right before you go. I pulled you on. I was like, oh, no.
Oh, well.
I just saw this.
I guess, you know, five people in the house. It's going to be, we're always going to kind of be on top of each other.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And well, thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, thank you so much for coming. I'm glad. I just love it whenever I invite people to be on the show and they're just like, yeah. I'm like, they don't even know what they're signing up for. They just, I love it. It's like,
Well, it was because it was you, Sarah. I mean, like, Sarah asked that. I was going to do it. That's it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, Ellen and I worked together a lot on Everywhere Book Fest in April. Yeah, we did most of the work in April, but it aired the first weekend of May. And you can still find all those videos and everything, by the way, Everywhere Book Fest on YouTube. And Eileen was one of the panelists.
It was a really fun event. And I still haven't watched as many of them as I would like to, but all the ones that I saw were just wonderful.
I saw everyone, and they were all great.
I remember one of the ones we pre-recorded. What was it? It was a Black Voices Matter, I think. Mm-hmm. Me and Jessica were the producers on it, and we were just like, we were watching and we were texting each other, and we're like, this is so good. This is so good. Like, the panel was just so good. Definitely go check those out.
Yeah, we had this great mix of panels that would just make you laugh hysterically, and then panels that made you just really think. And just, you know, you're just like listening to every word and going, oh, they're so smart. Why can't I be that smart? Well, that might be a me thing, but.
Yeah. Yeah, the panel with Raoul III, where they were drawing audience suggestions. That was so funny. I got the honor of producing that one too. So
I honestly want them to do a Chicken Wizard book though because of that panel.
It was so good. Yeah, definitely go check those out if you haven't seen them already. Heather said hi, Ellen.
Hi, Heather.
All right, so let's get into the question. So you're the co-founder of We Need Diverse Books. We mentioned that in your bio. A wonderful organization that now, at least to me, feels like an indispensable part of our writing and publishing community. Can you bring us back to the beginning and tell us how the organization got started and how it's evolved since those early days? And Eileen, you were there for those early days as well, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was. I still have those emails where we discovered, where we honed down. First, it was like, I need diverse books. And then it was like, I want diverse books. And finally, it was, we need diverse books. I mean, it was activism by committee, but in a really good way, I think. Mm-hmm.
I can't believe it's been 6 years already. I mean, it feels so long ago. And also not that long ago, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right? Like, but okay, so well, the short answer about how We Need Diverse Books started is that it was just many, many, many conversations that had been happening over the years. But specifically in 2014, right in March, the two op-eds by Walter D. Myers and Christopher Myers kind of really kicked off that conversation of, you know, where Walter Dean Myers' op-ed was titled, Where Are the People of Color in Children's Books? And Christopher Myers' op-ed was entitled The Apartheid of Children's Literature. And I mean, it, like, within a couple of weeks of that, of those op-eds being out there in the New York Times, BookCon then makes these very awkward announcements, right? And it was just kind of that thing where people were like, oh, see, this is what we're talking about. And we just started having conversations. I remember I started to talk on Twitter and I was like, we need to do something big, which, by the way, I had been talking to Lamar Giles about that. And I remember I was like, Lamar, we need to do something big. And Lamar was like, as long as it's legal, I'm in. And I remember talking about it. I think I was talking with Melinda Lowe. And the next thing I knew, lots of people were chiming in, including Eileen. And we just took that conversation offline. And the next thing we did was put together this hashtag and had a program. And basically that's how a grassroots campaign came to be. Mm-hmm. But the bigger question from that was, here you have a grassroots campaign, but then what do you do, right? What's that next step? And I've always been the person that says, you can't just talk about something. You actually have to do something, right? Because talking about it is not enough. What are the actions you can take to make the change that you want happen? So we came up with several programs, and they are our core programs to this day, which is the Walter Awards, which are named after Walter Dean Myers and honors the very best of diverse books. The WNDB in the Classroom Initiative that has donated over 15,000 diverse children's books to schools all over this country. Our mentorship program, which has mentored 49 emerging authors and illustrators. The Walter Dean Myers Grant, which provided financial support for 16 creators from marginalized communities. And our most famous grant winner being Angie Thomas. And of course, the one that I think is really was something that Walter Dean Myers wanted to do himself, and this is from a conversation we had with Linda Sue Park, was the internship grant, which was to put people of color and students, especially college students from different marginalized communities, in publishing to work from the inside out. And one of the greatest achievements we've made is that we have given 44 WNDB internship grants since beginning, and 30 of them have gone on to full-time positions in the publishing industry. Okay. So that to me is, it says it all right there. We've done some good work.
I mean, definitely WNBA's strength was realizing that the lack of diversity is a multifactorial problem, and that it affects every level within the publishing ecosystem, as we discussed, certainly not all on the authors. It's certainly not even all the editors, but it's on the marketing team, the sales team, you know, PR, the back end of things, as well as, you know, the teachers, librarians, and booksellers, who are the gatekeepers that get these books into people's hands. And, you know, one of the things that we realized was that to a certain extent, diverse books were being pigeonholed, or Meg Medina's word is siloed, being placed in the silo as something that is brought out during Black History Month or Asian American Heritage Month, you know, and being able to change the dialogue around the way that we discuss diverse books, explaining that they are universal rather than specific, that they are windows as well as just mirrors. I mean, they're not just for the kids of color or the disabled kids, or, you know, the kids whose sexuality and gender don't align with the dominant paradigm. They're for everybody. And that's still, I feel like, something that we're struggling with. Ellen, I was on a call with Jessica Kim recently, who's the author of Stand Up Yubi Chung, an adorable debut about a Korean-American girl who wants to be a stand-up comic.
You know, I can't wait to read that book.
It's one of my daughter's new favorite books. And we were talking, and she was telling me that, you know, 3-4 months ago, she was at a library event, and one of the librarians took her book and said, oh yeah, we don't really have that many Asians, and put it down. And Ellen, I literally made the face, right? Because, like, how many times did we talk about this 6 years ago? And so, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I remember you saying that, was it Sarwat Chadha? Mm-hmm. Like, said, he mentioned, someone at a bookstore said, oh yeah, we don't have many South Asians in our city, and Sarah was like, well, how many hobbits are there? How many, you know, dragons are there? You know, and the fact that people are still using these excuses is a little disheartening, but at the same time, I feel like so much is done. I feel like it's rare to come across librarians and teachers and booksellers who feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's the key of librarians and booksellers. They've been behind We Need Diverse Books. They've been kind of the momentum, the strength of fighting for our cause. So I feel like they won't be the ones really saying those things anymore, but we have to change the next level of people, right? One of the things that I talk about when I do presentations is how, when I first started talking about my books and diverse books, I would focus on the kids who needed to see themselves represented in the books. Hold on, my dog just opened my door. Hold on.
That's so great.
I don't know how my dog, it literally was closed. I think she uses her nose to open. Yeah, it's amazing. Anyway, so when I first started off, I really would be talking about those kids who needed to see themselves, because I remember not having that representation and not seeing myself until I was a grown up, right? The first positive representation. And the focus for me at first was, yes, the kids need to see themselves. And then I realized that was not enough. That's not the answer. All kids need to see everybody represented. Black kids need to see Asian kids need to see Latinx kids. All kids need to see the LGBTQI community and the disabled community represented in books. We need to see everybody, because that's the only way we can teach empathy. And, like, a lot of times when I consider the statistics about the lack of diversity, I wonder if there isn't a correlation between how little there was of, like, positive representative children's books, and how that correlates to the lack of empathy and racial and bias and prejudice and tensions that we have now. So I think that it becomes so much more important for us to make sure that the kids get those good positive reinforcements now for every kid, so that by the time they grow up, we won't have these same issues crop up. That's a hope anyway.
Yeah. All right. That was great. Jay, by the way, said we don't mind the dog.
Yeah, but you know what? Didn't she just want me to play with her the entire time?
All right, that was great. So we're going to switch gears a little bit, but we might come back to We Need Diverse Books a little bit later. Because I just think it's hilarious. By the way, right now we have three writers on this show. One is an engineer, one is a doctor, and one was a lawyer. So that's just great. But what made you want to make the switch from lawyer to author?
So I actually enjoyed being a lawyer, at least not the first 5 years of it, but as I was like becoming a more senior attorney, I was actually enjoying my work, but I really got tired of the politics of the office life, right? And then there was this major reshuffling of senior management at my old company, and they offered me the general counsel job, which is a great promotion, but had me report to somebody that I did not like. So my husband got really tired of hearing me complain, and he was like, why don't you just quit and work on that book that you've been talking about writing for forever? And I was like, all right, I will. And so I did. And I got to be honest, I don't miss it at all. Although my mom is still very disappointed that I'm not a lawyer anymore. And she keeps asking me when I'm going to go back to being a lawyer. And I tell her that I'll always be a lawyer because clearly I will always be her lawyer anytime she has a legal issue. So I've never actually given it up.
All right. Yeah, my mom keeps asking me, are you sure you don't want to go back to engineering?
Right?
No, I definitely made more money there.
Yeah. Well, me too.
I'm still trapped in medicine and using it as my way to finance my writing career. But actually, because of the pandemic, all these elective procedures are being delayed, and because of just how the timing of my advance checks, like this month is literally the first month in 10 years that I've earned more from writing than from being a doctor.
That's funny.
I don't know if I should applaud that. I don't know.
It's like funny and sad at the same time.
Like, I guess I don't really need that, you know? Maybe it's sort of a glimpse into early retirement. I can live with this.
All right. So I typed in the chat, Eileen, but I'm sorry. I realized that was supposed to be your question, the last question. That was my fault. I was just like,
oh, no, that's okay.
So we have a question from Patreon supporter Lodestar. So if you support my Patreon, you get to submit questions ahead of time that I may ask the guests. This one comes from Lodestar. He usually is not able to watch live. Sometimes he watches live, but a lot of times he catches a replay. So I'm not sure if he's here today. He said, hey, Ellen, I'm an Asian American adoptee here trying to break into writing. I wanted to know how you would market the wuxia genre to an American audience. I love it and I think it could work, but I was trying to figure out how to pitch it.
I love wuxia. I mean, in my list of favorite all-time movies are three classic wuxia movies: Hero, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and The House of Flying Daggers. I mean, just the most incredible, beautiful movies ever. And I have to admit, I was definitely channeling classic wuxia when I wrote my own prophecy series, which was a fantasy set in ancient Korea. I have to say, I think my biggest piece of advice to Lodestar is that you got to just write the story. Just write it. Don't worry about marketing it right now. Don't worry about genres. Don't worry about trying to Americanize it. I think whether or not it's wuxia, it's immaterial. The story comes first, right? He has to write that story as best he can. Has to hook the reader, has to hook the agent who he's going to query. I'm making assumptions here, actually. Assuming that he is trying to get his story published. I just want him to focus on the story and not worry about how to make American people accept the wuxia fantasy of it. I think that if he is telling a good story, it doesn't really matter. And quite frankly, I'm just waiting for somebody to do a Hero House of Flying Daggers remix in the US. I mean, I would throw all my money at that. So for me, it's really just write that book and the story will sell, right? It's not the gimmick or it's not what you say that you want to kind of glamorize it with. It's the basic story. But do I think a wuxia story would sell in the US? I actually do. I really do. I think that there's a market for it. I know that I would kill to read a story like that. So that's my very incoherent rant right there.
No, that's great. That's great advice.
I'm sorry, people like me who don't actually, I know from the movies, what exactly makes a wuxia movie a wuxia movie?
It's the martial arts, supernatural fantasy aspect of it.
Right.
That's, I mean, like, think about like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Yeah, yeah, right? No, that's the best description of it. I just didn't know whether it was a visual thing.
It's also, they're novels. They're based on classic wuxia novels and books. Okay. I always go to the visual, and so that's where I'm starting off. But I also think that that's how, when he's ready to sell his story, that's how he would pitch it. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon meets John Wick. I don't know. Like, think about how Hollywood is always pitching those things. And I think the fact that there were these really phenomenally well-made and blockbuster movies that did well worldwide is in his favor.
Yeah, I don't think it wouldn't be that hard to pitch.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Jay is texting Lodestar, and he said, tell them I said hi. So
please tell them I said hi, and thanks. Great question. And please, can I read your book when you have it ready?
Oh, wow. yeah, Brenda would also love some wuxia books. All right. Great. That was really great advice, Ellen, for just, I mean, that was specific to that, but also just great advice in general, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The story is king.
Yeah.
Yeah. And your passion for it will shine through and will be what markets it more than anything else, more than any genre. You know, there's so many examples of books and movies that have like been their own genre really, or been redefined while people view things. Of course I can't think of any of them right now, but
you're on the spot.
I'll think of them eventually.
I always think of Twilight. I mean, it's just like, if people think, oh, vampires, who's gonna, you know, who wants to read about that? And then here comes Twilight and it just blows everybody's expectations away with their sparkly vampires. I mean, it just, the story worked for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that as long as there's like the core of an emotional connection, like a character that someone can relate to, it doesn't matter what realm they live in, you know, what kind of fantasy world,
mm-hmm.
the character is someone that you can, that you want to follow, then.
For sure. Yeah. I always like think about one of my favorite reviews that I ever got on the A Word, was for Keeping Your Secret, which is my, you know, girl summer camp romance, teens, whatever. And the review was basically like, I'm a 72-year-old woman. I love this book. I thought it was so great. She was just like,
one of the things I used to say to other writers when they'd ask me, how am I ever going to know if anybody will read my book or if anyone will love it? And I truly believe that if you write a good story, there is an audience for you everywhere. And I think, you know what really proves that is like Wattpad and fan fiction sites. And people just pour their hearts into a story and just puts it out there. There's always going to be an audience for you. People love stories. And that's why it's so important for us to continue and not worry about whether it sells, but actually just write that story that you love to tell. Because if you love to tell that story, somebody is going to love to hear it and somebody's going to love to read it.
Yeah. I still remember early on, Angie Thomas tweeting is there any place in the industry for a book that has to do with the Black Lives Matter movement?
Right. Yeah.
And like, you could just tell, like, the way that the it was phrased, there was such vulnerability in it, and that she didn't know if anyone would be interested or not. And now it's like one of the biggest books of our category, you know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, when I think about it, if she had not gotten positive feedback at that moment and she didn't write that book, we'd be in that alternate universe of where there's no The Hate U Give and all the series of other wonderful books that came out, like, you know, wow, right? So the other thing I want to say is I think it's so important to be positive and to support people when they want to tell their story. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't believe in being negative. I think everybody's story should have an audience if you want to write it. So like, as hard as it is, so I'm going to digress again. I heard the story about this very famous award-winning writer who was asked one day why, you know, what was the secret to her success? And she said, and I don't even remember who it was, by the way, because I'm kind of, you know, pandemic brain, but she says, I went to this great MFA program with writers that were so much better than me. But when I graduated, I was the only one who had actually finished a book and submitted it. And that was my success. And she's like, there was no reason for me to have been any better than, you know, the other writers. The other writers were phenomenal. They just never finished their story. So you want to write your story, you have to finish it. You have to believe in it. Be positive about it, you know, and just, you got to keep trying. And us as mentors in the industry, we have to support the next generation of writers. Because I always say this, like, people are like, do you believe in mentoring? I'm like, hell yeah, yes, we have to mentor the next generation of writers. Because you know what? I didn't go through all that hell 6 years ago, and still for 6 years working on WNDB, not to have a new generation of writers come out, right? We do this not just for ourselves. We do it for the next generation of writers to keep doing that good work. Did I answer the question?
Yeah, definitely.
Sometimes I go on a rant and then I don't even remember what I was talking about in the first place. I'm like a grandpa.
That's fine. I mean, I always say it, you know, I say ahead of time, like wherever the conversation goes, that's where it goes. Cause that's, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I'd rather have a good conversation than just like stick to the preset questions. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
It's funny. I have the next scheduled question for you, but I'm not sure how it's going to fly because it's interesting. I actually wanted to ask you about how you can stay positive in the industry, specifically in the question, it was in regards to WNDB and the fact that so much has changed, but clearly because of all the issues that still come up, so much needs to change.
Right.
So how do you stay positive? How do you maintain your energy to resist and fight activist burnout, which, you know, I can definitely say that I've had at various times in all of my, you know, the areas in which I do activism, whether it be diverse books or intersex activism. Sometimes it just seems like the hill we're climbing is so steep that we're never going to see the end of it.
So, you know, for me, I'm all about the long game. Like, I can't worry just about what's happening now. You got to look at the long game. What's going to happen in the future? We're working really hard now to help people fight their way in an industry that has historically been really hard for them to enter. And, you know, like right now we're seeing our junior editors getting into the industry. We need to make sure that they become senior editors. We need to make sure that they become VPs. For us to win means that we have to not get upset when we lose sometimes, right? It always feels like we're taking two steps forward, one step back, three steps forward, four steps back, one step forward, no steps back. I mean, it's just this endless game of moving forward incrementally. And yes, we're going to have some failures in the process, but I think ultimately we'll have more successes. Like, I guess maybe I'm just a positive person in that way, although sometimes I can be just very realistic. But in this instance, I think that change can happen, but change is not always forever. And so if we want real change to happen, if we really want a better world, we have to just keep pushing forward. We have to celebrate those little successes, and we have to not get discouraged over our failures, because I believe that the future that we're working for is worth it for all of us. And I believe that it is in our grasp. I really do. So look at the long game. Don't worry too much about the failures now, the political climate. That will all change. It will all change for the better, I promise.
Wow. All right. I don't even know what to say. I feel really inspired, Ellen. Thank you.
I will say that I also, I mean, I'm not like, you know, just like this, you know, very happy-go-lucky, yay, everything is roses kind of person. I am actually very realistic. Mm-hmm. And there are moments when I definitely get down. And you know what the best thing to do at those moments? Delete Twitter, delete Facebook, go home, chill out with my family, read a lot of great books. And then when you have strengthened yourself again, go back into the battlefield.
Yeah. I mean, I think the key to this, to how this has been sustained, is that it was such an incredibly expansive group effort at the beginning. And one of the reasons it was so expansive, Ellen, is because early on you insisted on the definition of diversity being extremely broad, not just being about color and race, but also about the disability and sexuality and gender and religion. And that the fact that we loaded the boat really early on, I think, is what allowed this to continue. Because at any given time, people are going to be tired. People are going to be exhausted, or they're going to be busy with their day jobs. But because of the community that we built, because like our tendrils went in so many different directions, we were able to lift ourselves up when one person just can't carry the ball anymore, we pass it on to someone else. And it's been really amazing to see that, to see the way that our team has evolved and changed, you know, people coming and going. But there's always someone to carry on the ball at the end, or the baton, or to pass the baton to. And I'm mixing my metaphors.
Well, allyship is so important. I mean, we're not going to survive all on our own in our separate little silos, fighting and yelling at the world. Only together can we have a chance at surviving and actually succeeding. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember early on when an author who shall not be named, because I actually forgot their name. But anyway, I remember when they came up to me and they said, "I don't understand why you're making this about more than race. This WNDB should just be only about race, because race is the integral problem in this country." And I said, "Well, what about the kids who are, you know, LGBTQIA? What about the kids who are in the disabilities community? Are you just telling them that we don't care about them?" And she's like, "I'm not saying we don't care. I'm saying that our issues are more important." And I said to her, "I don't agree with you. I don't. I mean, I think if we are doing this for all kids, then all kids need to see themselves represented, and all other kids need to know about them, need to read about them, because it is a true fact of life that sometimes children's books is the only place that some kids will ever meet other people from different cultures, from different backgrounds and different communities." Mm-hmm. So that's why this movement has been always about the, you know, all marginalized communities and helping their voices grow. So yeah, thank you for reminding me, Eileen. That fight was from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that in not acknowledging all these other types of diversity, it prevents people from acknowledging the intersectionality of people's identities. You know, people of color who are gay and queer and trans people of color. people of color with disabilities, because I mean that's part of the things we were fighting against from the very beginning, was the idea that books can be too diverse. I mean, I remember when I was writing None of the Above, like there was no way in heck I was making my intersex character a person of color, because I knew that there is this conventional wisdom within the publishing industry that, you know, you can't have too many issues. And I'm like, I'm so glad that now we can say screw that. Like now we can have, you know, like depressed and like anxious, you know, people of color in books. You know, we can have, you know, I mean, Case and Calendar's Felix Ever After, you know, you can have so many books that talk about the many different ways in which people's identities can clash and amplify and how people are so multifactorial in their personalities and their identities. And the fact that we're able to have these digging really deep down into these specific stories, because specificity is what specificity is in its own way really universal, I think.
Yeah.
We fight the fight for everyone.
Catherine said, as a longtime classroom teacher, I've seen diverse books really make a difference in my classroom. And let's see. Okay. Laura said, it's been really neat to watch this movement grow and blossom. Have our final question. I hate to end this conversation, but I try not to let the show go too long over an hour, because I know that's a long time to sit and watch a YouTube video. So my final question that I ask every guest that I have on the show, Ellen, is what is the most important book that you've ever read and why? And you define important however you want.
Wait, just one?
try just one. you can add on if you want.
Oh. Well, I mean, like, I guess I have to go with, I say this is my basic answer because this is something I always talk about, in which case, when I talk about how the first time I ever saw myself on the pages of a book was mind-blowing, it actually just changed my world, was when I read The Joy Luck Club, because that was the first time ever that I saw a character that was like me, with a family that was like mine, with an immigrant experience that was just like mine. And it just didn't matter that the book was about Chinese Americans and I'm Korean American. It didn't matter, because there was my experience. And at that moment, I finally felt like if my story could be told and accepted by this, you know, this country, then maybe I don't have to feel like a fake American. Maybe I don't have to feel always like I'm the other, because finally here was my story for people to relate to. And that was just one of the most eye-opening experiences of my life. You don't know what you've never had, and then when you see it and you realize that this is what was missing all your life, it's almost as if the blinders have been ripped off and you go, no, this was actually not cool. all my life, all I've ever seen are these terrible stereotypes. I mean, a stereotype, whether or not it's a model minority stereotype or a bad stereotype, they're all stereotypes. And here I got to see a family, warts and all, right? That was just like mine. And that was my first time when I was 20 years old. And I can't help but think, like, well, how I would have been, would I not have gone through that period of like, loathing, where I hated myself and I hated being Asian and I had wished I was white and had blonde hair. I have light hair now, but that's dyed. But you know what I mean, right? Like that, this idea of fitting in that I never had. Would that have been different had I had books like my kids have now? Because those books now exist. And that's a phenomenal change that's happened in the industry, I believe. So yeah, so Joy Luck Club, that would be the book.
That's great.
That's the same book I mentioned in a talk that Adeeb Karam and Ashley Woodfolk and I are doing for ALA. Like the librarian asked which ALA Virtual, and I mentioned that too because it was the first time I had ever seen my family's dysfunction modeled in real life, and I felt so validated by
exactly
generational traumas and you know, yeah.
I know. Awesome. It was that, like, I feel you. This is me. This is my family. You know, and people who've never had that experience can't understand how mind-blowing that was.
But, at the same time, I know that Joy Luck Club has been really polarizing for some people because it has become so much that single story, right? Mm-hmm. The one that people go to again and again, because for so long it was like the only Asian movie that was made for 20 years with a predominantly Asian cast. And so many people, and the same way that other, you know, really key books have become like almost a straw man because, you know, people are like, my family isn't like that. My family isn't like that. Like that, it just goes to show how what a dearth of books like that there are that, you know, you and I have to choose the same book. You know, even though it's very, you know, you're Korean and I'm Chinese, because in that era, that was all we had. But like mm-hmm. now, you know, I'm so excited by all the middle grade books that I can show, you know, my daughter, whether it be, you know, Kelly Yang or Jessica Kim or Kat Ye. Like there's so many amazing, Linda Sue Park, there's so many amazing diverse books, diversely diverse books, you know, because they're not all contemporary. They're fantasy, you know, they're comedy. I'm really, really excited about where we're going as a publishing world. And I agree that we have to think positively about the fact that it's only going to get better.
I do. I think so, because here, right there is your answer. With more books, with more diverse books in middle grade and YA and picture books, these books now will help the kids now be more empathetic in a way that the kids that grew up with us, right? That this generation of people who are out there not wearing their masks and doing their things out there, like they did not learn to have empathy for people mm-hmm. like us, right? So we're changing that right now for the kids who are reading these diverse books. And that is for me one of the proudest moments. I'm so proud of the publishing industry for doing that and hopefully for getting it right, because also books that had bad rep were hurting us too.
Yeah. All right. Well, this was a great conversation. Ellen, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been really great having you.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to say goodnight to Ellen, and Eileen and I are going to finish up a couple of things, and then you can hang around, Ellen, or you can go whatever you need to do.
Okay. Thanks, guys, for having me. Bye.
All right. That was great. That was really good. All right. So it is time for the audiobook of the week, which is a thing that I do on the show just because I like audiobooks, and really there's no other reason besides that. And even though we had two YA authors on today, this audiobook is not going to fit with that at all. So, but I really enjoyed this book. I'm going to pull up the cover, and it is Lush Money by Angelina M. Lopez. Angelina was on the show the last episode, and her agent sent me some audiobooks, and this is one of them. And I really enjoyed this one. She called it on the show, what's the word? Oh my gosh, my mind just went blank. The word with the, that means like a very masculine. Man, I can't remember the word right now. Alpha. Wow. So she said it had like an alpha heroine, like a hyper alpha heroine.
I love it.
Thanks, Laura. No, that does not look YA at all. So here's a little like blurb from the publisher: a marriage of convenience and three nights a month. That's all the sultry self-made billionaire wants from the impoverished prince. And at the end of the year, she'll grant him his divorce with a settlement large enough to save his beloved kingdom. And so it's very sexy book. There's lots of sex in it. So just a heads up. and it's narrated by Scarlett Hayes, who's kind of a newer audiobook narrator. She only has 3 audiobooks that I could find, this one included. But she was really good, and she's going to be narrating the sequel. And also it's set in like partially set in a wine region in Spain. And so I loved all that too. Yeah, go check that out. And that's going to be added to my list of audiobook of the weeks, which I give away right now, which so you can choose if you win, you can choose any audiobook from audiobook of the week. And I have a list. So if you don't remember them, I can send you those. And I'm going to go ahead and send Eileen the winning number in the private chat right now, so I don't forget it. and also so I don't cheat, but mainly so I don't forget it. You can win any of the audiobooks of the week if you guess the number between, let's do 1 and 20 so we can try to make this go fast this time. Go ahead and put your number in. If I've read your number and said that's not it, then you can make a second guess. And I chose this number because on the Sesame Street episode I was watching with my niece earlier, it was the number of the day or whatever. So, all right.
Laura H. got it.
Yeah. Laura got it. 17. Yeah, that was the Sesame Street number of the day today. So, So Laura, you know how to contact me for sure. Contact me, however, Facebook, email, Twitter, text, whatever. You have all of them. So, and I'll send you the list if you need it, or you can just tell me which one you want if you already know for sure. And I'm going to remember to take that off the screen this time because I forgot last time. All right. Congrats, Laura. Yeah, I know. Number 7. Oh, I don't remember. There were like 17 circles and 17 triangles and 17 squares. I wasn't paying that much attention, to be honest, but well, it wasn't today's episode. It was a pre-recorded episode, but it's the one we were watching today. All right. So now it's time to talk about the viewer poll. And the question was, where do you purchase most of your print books from? And I have to share my screen. So if you'll just give me 1 second to make sure I'm selecting the right screen. And should come up. There it is. All right, so we have 40% of people say, and these, of course, are my followers, so it's skewed probably a little bit, mostly people inside the industry. 40% buy from indie bookstores, 32.5% from a bookstore chain, 19.5% from Amazon, and then 8% from other. And I felt bad on this one, choosing other, because I feel like I buy most of my print books at book signings, whether it's at a con or a single book signing. And so mine is probably other too, because it just depends who's the bookseller at the event that I go to. How about you? Do you know where you buy most of your books?
I try to do them through indie bookstores. But a lot of the time when shipping is an issue, then I typically do it through Barnes & Noble because I do have, I almost consider Barnes & Noble an indie bookstore these days.
Yeah.
It's a bricks and mortar bookstore. It's a place where you can go and you can smell the books and you can browse and you can talk to people. And my Barnes & Noble in Exton, Pennsylvania here is really one of the best YA sections I've ever seen. And so I feel a good amount of loyalty to them, as well as to the amazing bookstores around here, like Children's Book World in Haverford and Main Point Books and Reeds and Company in Phoenixville and in Collegeville Town Book Center. I mean, there are some, and I feel, obviously, I feel before 3 years ago, I bought pretty much every single one of my books at Chester County Books and Music, which closed its doors shortly after my launch. It actually closed twice before it closed for good.
Oh, no.
I had that grief in me. But it was a long, prolonged death. And so I feel very strongly about indie bookstores because yeah. literally 2 minutes away from my office, I could go there during lunchtime. And I kept it, I tried my hardest to keep it alive. I bought everything there. I bought every single book, every single gift, because they had a pretty good gift selection, you know, mm-hmm. cards for like birthday cards, like everything. Candy.
That's great. I am a minimalist, so I try not to buy as many books as I would otherwise. And so I mainly buy like signed books when I go to events. And otherwise I'm either not often ebooks, but usually digital audiobooks is how I do a lot of mine. Mm-hmm. All right. And finally, we're closing out with the reading quote of the week, which is, again, just something I do because I like quotes, and that's it. And so this one is from Cornelia Funke. I think that's how you say her last name. Do you know? That's how I've always said it. Yeah, I think that's it. I love her books, by the way. Which of us has not felt that the character we are reading in the printed page is more real than the person standing beside us? Yeah, I love that, especially coming from her. So if you haven't read any of her books, she wrote Ink Heart. That's one of the series with a long U sound. Oh, okay. You're going to have to call me later and tell me that, Jennifer. I have the worst time with pronouncing names of any kind. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. So Ink Heart, which is literally about people who read so well that the characters come out of the book and into the real world. So I love this quote from her. And Dragon Rider is one of the best audiobooks I've ever listened to. That's one of her middle grades, narrated by Brendan Fraser, and it's just incredible. So, yeah. All right. So that's pretty much it. I'm going to say goodnight to Eileen and finish up just the last couple of notes for y'all. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Eileen. I'm so glad you could come.
So fun.
Yeah. So have a good night, and I'll talk to you in a little bit. Bye. All right. So if you enjoyed this show, please don't forget to like and subscribe right down there so you don't miss another episode. Also, tell your friends, because that's how they find out about shows like this. And this one was really great, so I hope you post about it on social media for anyone who missed it. And you can subscribe to emails down below. They're just a day of reminders. And then also you can find the link for the Patreon in the description. Thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. I love this week. I don't even know. Yeah, I mentioned last episode that I was trying to do the podcast thing and I knew the podcast sponsors. And within a day, I had two additional podcast sponsors and I literally cried. So thank you all so much. And the social media and the website for our guests can be found in the description right now, along with the Pub Talk Live social media. It's just at Pub Talk Live on Instagram and Twitter. And you'll also in about 15, 20 minutes be able to see. Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about the show and find out how you can watch live, go to pubtalk.live. Thank you so much to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake, Jay Lynn, and Reframe.